Dear Lord, thank you for the beautiful wisdom of Nehemiah and how you speak right through the entire chapter and give us so many tools to use. Lord, you've blessed us in this way, and I am simply your messenger. May you warm each woman's heart to what you want her to receive. Amen. Nehemiah 6 is full of ploys. For me to talk about a ploy, I realized it's easier to know what it is than to explain it. So for fun, let's try to identify the ploys in these three examples. Are you ready? First one, you receive a buy one, get one free fast food coupon. So what's the ploy here? I'd say this one is a fairly benign marketing scheme to coax you into buying something you typically wouldn't eat. So here's another one. And my goodness, this is timely. A sports agent supplies a professional athlete with steroids that can easily be missed in drug testing. So what's the ploy here? Well, I see two. One is the agent tries to get a star player to do something illegal that he or she wouldn't ordinarily do. And the other ploy is the athlete cheats by using the banned substance to gain an unfair advantage. Now, how about this one? In the Garden of Eden, Eve was tempted by the serpent to take what she wasn't supposed to have. She ate the beautiful, tasty apple, even though God had commanded her not to. Satan deceived Eve into disobeying God, which is the ultimate ploy and the same battle against evil we face today. How about you? Have you faced ploys where you thought you were winning your particular battle, only to find that once the latest calamity died down, you were hit with a new wave of ploys you never expected? In this chapter, Nehemiah was bombarded by schemes and plots and ploys that came from many angles. Up to this point, Nehemiah and his team had rebuilt the wall to half the height they wanted it to be. Through the many days and nights of toil, while half of the workers built and the other half stood guard, they lugged boulders and piled stones one on another to make a fortress for Jerusalem once again. Without the wall, their beloved city of David was utterly open to attack. Nehemiah and the Jews had worked with all their hearts, and God handed Nehemiah the exact work he wanted him to do. But opposition from Nehemiah's enemies had heated up and wasn't letting up. With his weary, smelly, untrained, but dedicated team of volunteers, Nehemiah had gotten close to completing the most important part of the project, hanging the doors at the gate entrances. This was a precise job and one of the most critical aspects of the project. The gates were the entry and exit points for commerce and for letting in the desirable people while keeping out the dangerous ones who meant them harm. Assaults from the surrounding tribes typically were concentrated at the gate areas because the invaders couldn't scale the high walls. Nehemiah 6, with its total of 19 verses, is piled high, rock upon rock, with God's provisions. I've divided the chapter into three divisions that I've called ploys, verses 1 through 8, prayer and ploys, verses 9 through 14, and the third division, praise and more ploys, verses 15 through 19. What we'll discover in this chapter is that when ploys are coming nonstop from the enemy's hands, God will strengthen my hands to complete the work he's given me to do. This passage highlights several leadership traits that Nehemiah exhibited to resist the constant ploys of his foes and complete the mission. God helped him be a secure and stable leader who was perceptive about his adversaries and remained God's faithful servant with clear priorities. He kept his focus on one goal, building the gates and the walls, and making the holy city secure and strong so that the Jews could settle in their homeland. Nehemiah was a hedgehog, after all. Remember the hedgehog principle? When God moves in your heart and hands you a work to do, his gracious hand will be on you. He'll strengthen your hands to complete the work. Before we get going, bring to mind the work he's put in your heart to do. What rebuilding project does he have you working on? Whether we're moms at home, or working in the marketplace, or in ministry, or all three, we're called not just to do the work, but complete what he has selected for us. I call this project management. In each previous chapter, Nehemiah has shown how he was effective as a project manager. He trusted his profound source of power and was able to move through a broad range of responsibilities. He organized, supervised, encouraged, and was the point person confronting injustice and nasty allegations towards himself and his people. He relied on God to guide him through major threats and risks so that they could all get the job done. Who do you rely on most often when you need to get your work done? I've spent a good part of my life as a project manager, as a high school and college teacher, and later in high tech and in nonprofit work. I noticed time and again that the biggest challenge for any project manager is dealing with contrary competitive people who will do all that it takes to have it their way, right? Trying to successfully negotiate or collaborate with strong-willed power brokers can be the heaviest obstacle to moving a project to the desired goal. And I know we know that. So Nehemiah faced extraordinary people problems. In the first division, which I've named ploys, he confronted increasingly desperate leaders who weren't the least bit happy that their efforts to stop the wall construction were failing. Through accusations and schemes, his adversaries' power plays were designed to discourage him and his team so that they'd what? Stop building. Verses 1 and 2 read, "When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arab, and the rest of our enemies that I had rebuilt a wall, and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message, 'Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono.' But they were scheming to harm me." Notice the verse refers to these men as enemies, as they've been called in earlier chapters. An enemy is a true adversary who feels enough animosity towards someone else that he wants to somehow destroy the other. That definitely fits the description of these three. They were Nehemiah's chief antagonists, still seeking his downfall. Julia mentioned the territories these men controlled when we studied Nehemiah 4. Sanballat, now get this, Sanballat is a Babylonian name that means sin has given life. As a Horonite and as the governor of Samaria, he controlled the cities northwest of Jerusalem that guarded the main road leading into Jerusalem. Then you have Tobiah, the Ammonite. who may have been governor of nearby Ammon on the east. Records show Geshem the Arab had a highly profitable spice trade, which would have been hindered by Nehemiah restoring the Jewish kingdom right along his precious trade route. So we get a clearer picture of why these men became even more threatened by a protected city. Sanballat and Geshem were scheming to lure Nehemiah outside of his safety zone so that they could trap him and undoubtedly attempt to ambush him. They were making this a deliberate, personal attack. But Nehemiah was too shrewd to fall for their trickery. He diplomatically replied in verse 3, "So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Why should the work stop?" Nehemiah demonstrated the godly leadership trait of discernment. He was able to discern the motives of those who were plotting against him so that they could keep their political and economic power base. And if you want to take notes, discernment is the ability to recognize good and evil. We find Nehemiah, under the guidance of God, used the 4 D's of discernment. He defined the situation, detected the signs of ungodly behavior, then discriminated whether to get involved based on behavior he'd seen before. Then he could decide what to do. Discernment is an on-the-spot gift God gave this man who consistently checked in with him in prayer. Nehemiah was not only able to decipher his enemies wanted to deceive him, but he was self-controlled in how he responded and wouldn't allow them to distract him. By God's hand, he stayed focused and true to what God was calling him to do. Why should the work stop? Satan's real ploy is getting us to quit and run. Run spiritually, run emotionally, and run into more trouble. Can anyone relate to feeling a ploy to quit? A ploy to get distracted from God's purposes? I can. So Nehemiah didn't receive just one invitation to meet outside of Jerusalem with his political foes. But over several weeks, he got the same invitation 4 times, as stated in verse 4. 4 times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Personally, if I were a busy head of government and got the same invitation more than once, I would be very suspicious and a little insulted. If my presence was so desired, the least these guys could do is be more creative in devising ways to get my attention and snare me. It was wise for Nehemiah to tell Sanballat and Geshem, "Oh no," to meeting on the plain of Ono. Interesting that Nehemiah matched their same message with his same answer. He was as persistent in resisting them as they were in trying to intimidate him. Interesting that Nehemiah matched their same message with his same answer. I suspect this was some sort of treacherous mind game they were playing. Obviously, these influential men, and they were not getting the cooperation they needed from Nehemiah. First, they weren't able to stop him from building the wall, and now they weren't able to isolate him to stage a surprise attack. The stakes got higher as they continued to lose control and as their power was undermined. Early in the passage, Nehemiah showed us a godly leadership trait that we can persist to resist amidst continuous ploys. Say that fast 5 times. We can persist to resist amidst continuous ploys. How do you persist to resist? Nehemiah refused to compromise with those who tried to pull him away from God's purposes to fulfill their own. He persisted in the midst of heavy resistance. But the mind games escalated into political hardball with the next round of Sanballat's tactics, starting with verse 5. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter. Check out this ploy. Again, Nehemiah received the same invitation plus an unsealed letter. Ordinarily, a letter was written on a sheet of papyrus or on leather, rolled up and tied with string. To ensure that the letter was private and authentic, it was sealed with a lump of clay imprinted with an identifying symbol. Remember how the kings would use their signet rings to make their seal official? Only those with the authority to open the letter could read it. This letter was deliberately left open to the public as part of Sanballat's mastermind. In those days, an open letter from Governor Sanballat to Royal Governor Nehemiah would be highly intimidating and insulting. Sanballat, it seems, was trying to elicit a lot of ill will and suspicion among Nehemiah's neighbors by the fact that the unsealed letter could be read by anyone as the couriers made their way on horseback en route to Jerusalem. Certainly, if Nehemiah's Jewish workers got wind of the contents of the letter, Sanballat, or should I say Satan, might be able to create enough dissension and division among Nehemiah's loyal followers to forge a revolt. This was blackmail. Further, Sanballat added more indictments in the letter by circulating gossip about Nehemiah and his supposed ambitions, as we read in verses 6 and 7, in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king, and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah." Now, this report will get back to the king. So come, let us confer together. Using Geshem and a vague reference to other nations as Sanballat's allies, he accused Nehemiah of inciting nothing less than a rebellion. His smear campaign alleged that Nehemiah would hire prophets to proclaim him as the king of Judah. What could be farther from the truth? Sanballat threatened to expose Nehemiah as a power-hungry revolutionary whose corrupt and sacrilegious purposes would make him a ruler that had more power than Sanballat and would even contest King Artaxerxes' authority. Just like childish rumor mongers, Nehemiah's enemies upped the ante of outrageous accusations, claiming they would tattle about Nehemiah to Artaxerxes, who just happened to be 1,000 miles away. "Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me." I'm not so sure. Oive Izmir. This had to be so offensive and scary for Nehemiah. His sovereign God was being mocked, and he was being used as bait. Doesn't the fear aroused from these tactics remind us of a very real evil that has always been present? The devil's pressure on Sanballat was designed to prod Nehemiah into caving in. Such burdensome intimidation was meant to plant enough fear in Nehemiah that he would finally cooperate with his enemies which would be one of Satan's fondest desires. Nehemiah faced his obvious external enemies, but he also had his internal enemies, the enemies of fear and the urge to retaliate so that he could protect himself and his people. Ever felt the urge to retaliate against your enemies? By spreading lies, Nehemiah's accusers hoped to manipulate him into capitulating. Manipulate to capitulate. I like the word capitulate, not just because it rhymes, but it means to surrender or give in. That's the ploy, to capitulate, to quit the work. Royal Governor Nehemiah was innocent, but was threatened by a deadly rumor mill that had the potential to destroy his life, his position, and the future of the Jews. We know how this works today as we watch politicians take the fall because of gossip spread about them in the media. Think of a time when you received a version of an unsealed letter that could or did tarnish your reputation. What did you do to defend yourself? Let's step back for a moment to look at the damage gossip can do in our own lives when we deliver it or are the brunt of it. Someone has defined gossip as news you have to hurry to tell somebody else before you find out it isn't true. I've heard gossip is rumor or talk of a personal, sensational, or intimate nature. Gossip is sin. Usually the person who started the gossip can't be identified, and the gossip is mostly exaggerated, inaccurate, and designed to inflict personal hurt. When we gossip, we tend to ignore that by making such careless comments, we can change how a person is perceived and understood. Words carry the power to affect a person's image and reputation. When we're careless, we care less. Gossip demonstrates that our internal judgments have gotten the best of us. When I think I'm prone to gossip, here are some questions I ask myself. Do I say things about another to be the one in the know? Do I insert very private information about another person into a prayer request? Do I try to collect allies who will support the gossip by asking them for their opinions? How about this type of gossip that we can easily overlook? In forwarding emails, am I careful to remove email addresses of those who don't need to be involved? And do I delete the long thread of earlier exchanges that give too much confidential information? I can be bold like Nehemiah to put a stop to gossip by inwardly asking myself a couple preliminary questions like, does this build this person up? Or, is this any of my business? And then I can respond, I wonder if I should be privy to this. Would you mind if I check with the person you're talking about to get her perspective? Nehemiah's leadership traits for dispelling gossip were simple and powerful. He took his hurt to God and prayed for God's strength. He calmly denied the charges and told the truth. And he transferred responsibility back to his accusers. Nehemiah trusted that God would allow honest people to recognize his honest character. And he went on about his business, praying that God would uphold his reputation. He offered a rebuttal to Sanballat's gossip with verse 8. I sent him this reply, "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head. As I mentioned, Nehemiah calmly denied the charges with the truth, and he let Sanballat know that his denunciations were lies. When ploys hurt, pray. We have an image here of how Satan relentlessly tries to attack believers with his evil intrigues. But ploy after ploy, we thwart him by our godly prayers. The first truth in our study is that I can expect heavy opposition as God's plan is carried out, especially as others lose power. Why then am I not surprised when I'm personally attacked and falsely accused? Ploys will come. We can expect them. In the first 8 verses of Nehemiah 6, we see an enemy far more cunning than Sanballat and far more destructive than the pain caused by gossip. The great deceiver at work. Our greatest defense against our greatest deceiver is praying to God Almighty. Our greatest defense against our greatest deceiver is praying to God Almighty. He will arm us with his strength. Amen to that. Actually, our behavior is not against flesh and blood, our husbands, our children, our parents, our colleagues, or even our government. We fight against a dark world of evil forces we cannot see. But God sees. Nehemiah concluded that his enemies were doing everything they could to instigate fear in him. Yet they did not succeed because Nehemiah had the supreme protection of prayer. In verse 9, he says, they were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. All the ploys from our enemy's hands bring us to a place where we pray, strengthen my hands. Prayer was most certainly Nehemiah's strength and security. The powerful protection he received is the heart of the second division, prayer and ploys. He didn't buckle under the weight of the ploys and attacks, and he wasn't demoralized by the rumors because he believed God was fighting for him. He maintained his role as governor and his position of authority as he asked his Lord to strengthen him so that all of the workers who had fought against such intense aggression could complete the wall and stay strong. He trusted his king would vindicate him before the Persian king. When I'm afraid and intimidated by other schemes, what do I gain by praying? What's in it for me? As I pray, I have the privilege to dialogue with God and gather more spiritual sustenance. My faith grows as he protects me and I witness the outcomes he brings. I'm encouraged and given more courage to carry on amid the ploys and not get too caught up in my feelings, which I can do. In fact, prayer helps me rise above my fear feelings, and I'm able to complete the work he has for me to do, his way rather than my way. What's in it for me is my thinking gets lined up with his. As I have my audience with the Lord, there are no limitations to what he can do. And we know this. Those applauding in the heavenlies rejoice that I'm victorious in doing my part well, no matter how others are acting. The intimidation continued in Nehemiah's next phase of battle. A prominent Jew laid a trap for him, coaxing him to hide in the temple, to escape his pursuers who were going to kill him in the middle of the night. Cowards. More fear stirred up with more threats to Nehemiah's reputation. Verses 10 through 13. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, "Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night, they are coming to kill you." But I said, "Should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go." I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this. And then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Nehemiah was being set up once again, but he didn't act like a victim. As a layman, he wasn't permitted to go into sacred areas of the temple. Had he done so, he would have violated the sanctity of God's holy chamber, and by law was subject to death. At the least, he would have been defamed and ostracized for life. With God's protection, Nehemiah quickly discerned Shemaiah was a false prophet paid by Tobiah and Sanballat to further provoke him and prophesy against him. He showed the leadership trait of courage as he dismissed this religious impostor and refused to sin against sovereign God. Confronted by human wickedness, Nehemiah served God in spite of his fear and did not yield to temptation. His courage had divine fingerprints. In my mind, I tried to walk in Nehemiah's shoes to grasp how he was taunted. And I know there are women in this room who have been tested to your capacity. For any of us, when our strength is waning and we feel we can barely fend off the latest ploy, it's enough, it's perfectly enough to pray, "Lord, strengthen my hands." Nehemiah had been betrayed, and again, he took his distress to prayer, asking God to intervene and deal with those determined to defeat him. He released his enemies to God and prayed in verse 14, "Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me." The key word, remember, is mentioned in this verse and seven other times in Nehemiah, as Julia has mentioned. Our sustained by prayer, Nehemiah, beseeched God to handle his adversaries and take account of what they had done. I believe he trusted God to determine the consequences for these sinners. As we come to the close of the second division, our second truth is that as I pray amid the many ploys, God will strengthen my hands. The battle between Nehemiah's righteousness and his enemy's evil raged on and gathered momentum. But his oppressors couldn't stop the work of the wall or scandalize Nehemiah's influence and leadership. The third and last division is praise and more ploys. Let's look for what motivated, exhausted Nehemiah. How could it be that other Jews would join the malicious outsiders to cultivate more unrest? In a few verses, we'll encounter the same rich Jews that Nehemiah had reprimanded in chapter 5. They'd taken an oath not to charge interest to their poor Jewish brothers, but now they had become traitors to their own people because their personal prestige and power were threatened. Yet in spite of all of the contentiousness, verse 15 tells us, so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. Did you hear that? With all the ploys and opposition, the wall was built in 52 days. Doesn't that give us hope? No forces of evil could stop the miraculous completion of the wall. In less than 2 months, Nehemiah's crews, having worked day and night, did the humanly impossible and finished the Jerusalem wall in 52 days. They persevered and rebuilt from ruins and rubble to restore their holy city. They did not quit. With man, this is impossible. But with God, all things are possible. And Nehemiah reported reactions to this miracle in verse 16. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done, how? With the help of our God. As I'm sure the Jews reveled in their answered prayer, how do we revel in our answered prayer? We can rejoice when our enemies are subdued, whoever they may be, as they lose confidence because our God has helped us. In the midst of an incessant barrage of assaults, the dedicated, hardworking, loyal Jews who stayed on course with God tasted victory and sweet justice with the help of God. The fear tactics hurled at the Jews by surrounding nations had boomeranged. Nehemiah persevered and enacted a part of God's master plan that impacted the Jewish nation for generations to come. Doesn't that encourage us that he can rebuild from ruins in our lives with God's speed? 52 days. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this were the end of the story? However, the conspiracy continued to grow from within Nehemiah's circle of associates. Jewish nobles, men from the royal tribe of Judah, were cooperating with enemy insiders like Tobiah. They were educated Jews who knew God had promised a Messiah from their lineage, and yet they were blatantly disobeying God. Where was their right fear and reverence for God? They had fallen away from him, forgotten who to trust, and had forfeited their heritage as chosen people in order to live out a worldly claim to fame and fortune. We read in verses 17 through 19. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them, for many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Era, all these names, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshullam, who's a priest, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling me what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. Nehemiah's nemesis, Tobiah, had literally become the devil's advocate and had promoted an underground of secret letters passed back and forth among some of the nobles. Tobiah likely persuaded them with flattery and enticed them to follow his corrupt thinking. In these exchanges, some men swore a loyalty oath to him because they sought advantage through Tobiah's family connections. They may have hoped to win Tobiah's favor in case he and his accomplices were able to take control of Jerusalem from Nehemiah. Part of their approach was to tell Nehemiah about Tobiah's so-called good deeds, which Tobiah then capitalized upon by sending intimidating letters to keep pressure on Nehemiah. What a sinister mess. My throat is sinister. In my own work example, I can relate to how Nehemiah fought a storm of opposition while still being protected by God. I was hired into a wealthy family-run organization of believers where my job was to grant large sums of money to worthy causes. A few months after I'd been in the position, without warning, the family member I worked with most closely gave a brief notice and left. He had been groomed to administrate the family's legacy, even though it wasn't his calling. In fact, he wanted to be a pastor. Now that he was gone, I was handling both his responsibilities and mine, but I was mainly tolerated so that I could manage the workload. Early on, I was considered a key person, but now the tables had turned, and I was being pressured to quit my job so that the firm wouldn't have to pay unemployment. As a Christian organization, this was confusing to me, as it must have been for Nehemiah to deal with the Jewish nobles. What was at stake for me? I'd already taken a 50% cut in salary from my former job. I'd been prayerful and diligent in my job search, so I thought this was where the Lord had placed me. I started asking myself survival questions. How would I pay my bills if I were unemployed? As a single woman and at my age, who would hire me? How would I be able to continue serving in ministry? I really felt intimidated about my future and prayed fervently that God would strengthen me to do the work he had called me to do. I placed my struggles time and again in his hands. Christian friends prayed for me, and my pastor periodically visited so that we could pray together. I noticed that even though I was still effective at my job, there were secret conversations going on behind my back, which reminded me of what Nehemiah experienced. One long-term loyal employee explained that the unfair way I was being treated was the same for her in her first years. However, that wasn't much consolation. After a year of working in a very strained environment, I had developed some health problems and wasn't sleeping well, and by then I was forcing myself to go to work each day. Finally, the head of the organization called me into the conference room to fire me, explaining that since the economy was collapsing, the organization would need to downsize and move into less expensive offices, which actually they did do. I thanked God for removing me from a situation full of opposition, and I thanked him for giving me a character test I will never forget. He showed me firsthand how he strengthened my hands and kept me faithful. During that stressful period, and recently, as I've studied Nehemiah 6, I've gained insights that make the third truth very real. I can be confident God's plan will prevail in spite of the odds against me. Slim odds are but God odds. What followed for me was a long stretch of trusting that the Lord would provide day by day. At times, I couldn't see God's plan for me. I grieved. And once in a while, I did despair. And I had to reach deeply into savings to meet my financial commitments. But I witnessed the Lord sending little miracles as I wrestled with fear. I kept on task as he molded my character and slowly opened new opportunities. I trust He has me just where He wants me, and He will fight for me. The power battles Nehemiah fought were big and tormenting. Yet, in spite of the odds against him, with God, Nehemiah built a new way of life for the Jews. He never gave up on God, and he never gave up on what God called him to do. With the main work of the wall completed, his responsibilities shifted to managing how to protect Jerusalem. When we're tempted to quit, we can look to Nehemiah. Ploys, ploys, ploys. Pray, pray, pray. Strengthen my hands. Dear Lord, what a beautiful example of a leader who desperately needed you to carry out the work you called him to do. And you strengthened his hands.